Support for news comes from the Overbrook Foundation, supporting national advocates for pregnant women, working for all women, at advocatesforpregnantwomen.org.
This is The Daily Circuit. I'm Carrie Miller along with Tom Weber. What's it like for a community that's been devastated by a natural disaster to start over, to take on that huge task of rebuilding? Two guests in depth at 9 o'clock from Greensburg, Kansas and Joplin, Missouri. And then, Tom, it's Thursday, so it's time for the Climatecast with Paul Hudner. We're going to ask whether there is a link between these monster tornadoes and what's happening with the warming of the climate. So the Climatecast coming up a little later.
Carrie, we're also keeping an eye on Lilydale Park in St. Paul, where the rock slide yesterday, the mudslide, killed one child. They're still looking this morning for a second child who is missing. That also leads our regional news this hour. Search and recovery efforts did resume this morning for the child who's not been seen since the rock slide killed a classmate and injured two others yesterday at a St. Paul park along the Mississippi River. Ground that was saturated by persistent rain gave way yesterday as a group of fourth graders from a St. Louis Park elementary school walked along a path near the edge of a bluff in Lilydale Regional Park. Police and firefighters dug frantically with shovels in their hands to get to the children. One was buried to the waist, another completely buried. Three children were taken to Regents Hospital. One was pronounced dead there. Crews are searching for a fourth child believed buried in the mudslide. They had to suspend operations last night because of safety concerns. Mayo Clinic employees and local and state officials are celebrating the clinic's proposed 20-year, $5 billion expansion plan for Rochester. Governor Mark Dayton still has to sign the tax bill, which commits $327 million in state aid for Rochester. The bill also authorizes the city of Rochester and Olmsted County to raise $128 million in local taxes to help with the expansion. Rochester's City Council President Randy Staver says the city still has to determine how it will make its obligation for Mayo's expansion plan work. The state legislation allows Rochester to raise those taxes by increasing the local sales taxes and adding a food and beverage tax, along with taxing certain entertainment events.
I think some folks are very concerned that this is all going to happen overnight, and it's not. Certainly we'll want to get going, but this is literally decades of work, so the impact will unfold accordingly.
Staver anticipates the city will make some of those decisions by the end of the year. North Dakota's governor and congressional delegations say they will continue to push for a new air refueling tanker mission at Grand Forks Air Force Base. The Air Force yesterday chose McConnell Air Force Base in Kansas as the main operating site for the new KC-46A tanker. That's where the military will base 36 of the new aircraft base starting in 2016. The Kansas base beat out three others for the planes, including Grand Forks. The Grand Forks base once had a tanker mission, but now supports unmanned aircraft. North Dakota officials say the base could still get the new tankers as more of them are based in the future. A Dakota County judge has pleaded guilty to DWI after his Christmas Eve arrest in St. Paul. Judge Michael Sovis was arrested Christmas Eve after hitting several parked cars in St. Paul. Court documents show his blood alcohol level was 0.28. And Carrie, that is the latest regional news here on the Daily Circuit.
Thank you, Tom. Now, in depth on rebuilding.
I honestly don't know how I'm alive right now. And I knew in that little car, I just knew she was gone.
Nothing matters except family right now.
Here we are at Greensburg, Kansas. And as you can see, we have complete destruction.
We walk up our basement stairs and we didn't see anybody. And this was 10 minutes after the tornado. We thought we were the only ones alive.
Those are voices from communities who have known what it's like to start over. In May of 2007, an EF5 tornado struck the small town of Greensburg, Kansas. It killed 10 people and it destroyed almost every house and business in the community. It almost blew Greensburg right off the map, some said. In May of 2011, Joplin, Missouri was hit by a mile-wide EF5 twister that killed 162 people, the deadliest tornado in the United States since the 1940s. Both communities did what more Oklahoma must do. They took stock, they gathered their strength, and they rebuilt. How did they do it? That's what we're going to talk about today, and I'd like your experience with this as well. Do you have some experience with this? Have you had to start over after, let's say, a natural disaster or a fire? What was that like? What do you know now that you wish you'd known then? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Reach me on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, and you can go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the Hour Show to comment. Our guest, Bob Dixon, is the mayor of Greensburg, Kansas, and he's with us today from Greensburg, Kansas. Hi, Mayor. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning, Carrie. It's a pleasure to be here. And again, our thoughts and prayers go out to all those affected, especially those in Moore, Oklahoma, and the whole region down there in Oklahoma.
You really know what they're going through, don't you?
It's very difficult times.
Jane Cage is with us, chair of the Citizens Advisory Recovery Team in Joplin, Missouri. She recently received a national award for her contribution to the recovery efforts, and she's with us today from Joplin. Jane, welcome to you. It's really good to have you with us as well.
Thank you, and good morning.
Later, Nancy Carlin is going to be with us. She's professor in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Northern Colorado. Mayor, I saw a photograph yesterday of what your town looked like after the tornado, plus you were grieving the loss of 10 of your citizens. Can you remind me what it was like to walk through town the morning after that tornado came through in 2007?
Well, Carrie, again, we were very blessed. We lost 11 of our friends and neighbors, but it could have been a whole lot worse because of the early warning system of the National Weather Service that allowed people 20, 25 minutes of sirens to go off to seek shelter. But immediately afterwards, you're in when all your possessions are gone, the house is leveled, just like you saw pictures on TV of Moore. It's you're in a state of shock. It's just like losing a loved one. There's a whole gamut of emotions. But the main emotion that comes out is you're looking for friends and family and neighbors and make sure everybody's accounted for. All the material possessions are pale to the human spirit and looking out for each other. It's just a total devastating experience, and I know Jane's experienced that in Joplin and all over the United States in the last few years, and really for decades this is happening.
Mayor, I appreciate you correcting me on that number. You lost 11 citizens of the town, not 10.
Yes, there was 11 in town, Carrie.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Did it occur to you to say, or do you think it occurred to some of the citizens of the town to say, we could just walk away from this rubble and we could move to other cities or towns and start somewhere new? We don't have to rebuild this.
Well, from the very beginning, this is our home, this is our community. And the citizens and all the volunteers that came to help and neighboring communities, really there was no question in our mind that we were going to rebuild the community. You know, our ancestors built a community for us. And so it's our responsibility, because it is our home, to rebuild the community for future generations.
Jane, to come out of this, to be grieving the people that you lose in the community, to be looking around and fully absorbing that devastation, how soon can you really start to rally the town, and how soon could you rally the townspeople of Joplin to the idea of rebuilding?
I would say within a week after the tornado, FEMA Long-Term Community Recovery came to visit Joplin. And it's interesting, Bob and I have the same contact there, so there was a lot of longevity in that office. And they suggested that citizens would need a role in recovery because in some ways it really provides hope to the community. So we had our first public input meeting about 6 weeks after the tornado.
Did that seem the right time to wait for 6 weeks to see where the community was going to be on this?
You know, I'm not sure if there's a definite time frame, but I can tell you for us it felt like the right time to stop looking around at what was, you know, present and look ahead to what could be. We had about 350 people come to that first public input meeting.
Wow.
And I can tell you that when I looked around the room, I knew people who had lost their home. I knew people that had lost somebody that they loved, and they still cared enough to come that night.
How did you, Jane, step up and decide that you would be one of the people who led the efforts? I'm sure you knew that was going to require some diplomacy and some real collaboration.
I would say I didn't have any idea what I was getting into, and I agreed that I could be the chairman of this. But I would say the reasons that it worked well for me were that, number one, nothing happened to me personally on my home or at the business. So I didn't have to rebuild either one of those, and I think that's a very time-consuming process, emotionally and physically. And then second, I think just like Bob, if you live in a community that you love and you see the devastation around you, it's nearly impossible not to step up to help.
Mayor, did you look around the room at whatever meetings followed the tornado in 2007 and identify people that were going to need to do what Jane Cage did and is doing in Joplin, who would have to lead this?
We were very blessed at the time of the tornado to have a great leadership with the mayor at the time, the city administrator, city council, county commissioners. But our situation just a little different in the fact that our whole community was basically homeless.
Wow.
And so FEMA put us up a big tent in the park after we cleaned some debris off. And in those initial, as Jane said, in those initial meetings with FEMA in the long-term recovery plan, our process lasted about, we met at least a minimum of once a week. We would have 400 and 500 people show up to community meetings. And the reason is because it was a chance for people, number one, to get back together as a community. And I like to say we hugged together, we cried together, we laughed together, we ate meals together, we had community church service together. So it became about, and this sounds a little cliche, but for us it was about faith, family, and friends. And that really drove the recovery process and the long-term recovery plan and the sustainable master plan that was developed over about a 12-week period. And that focus and that input is true leadership by community members that chose to come to a meeting and have their voices heard and the input of how we wanted to proceed in the rebuilding process.
Yeah, we're going to talk about how the rebuilding really lived up to the name of the community. If you're just tuned in this hour, we're looking at what Moore, Oklahoma confronts now, which is rebuilding a significant part of that town that has been devastated by the tornado on Monday. And we're hearing the voices of experience this morning from Greensburg, Kansas, and also from Joplin, Missouri, two communities that know what it's like to be devastated by a natural disaster like this and then decide that they're going to rebuild. What did they go through? What did the community go through? How did they change things in the rebuilding? That's what we're talking about this morning. I'm asking you, if you have some individual experience with this, maybe you live in a community where a tornado has come through. I mean, a tornado came through North Minneapolis. Maybe you know what it's like individually to have to decide that you're going to rebuild. Maybe you've experienced a fire or some other tragedy like that where you've had to say, hey, I'm going to rebuild. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You go to the Daily Circuit page and click on this hour's show to comment, and you can reach me on Twitter, at CarrieNPR, to David in Minneapolis. Hi, David, your question.
Yeah, well, Florida, when they got hit, they changed their building code so that new construction has to be bolted with steel rods from the sill plate down through the walls into the foundation and steel straps across the roof and bolted to those rods.
Right.
And also, I don't care if the ground is solid clay with a 2-foot water table. You dig a hole, you put in a shelter, you waterproof the shelter, you backfill the walls with 2, 3, 4 feet of sand so that the clay doesn't crush the walls, and then you install a pump. And you know,
you mean for
a battery-powered pump
David,
that
you
if
mean
the
for
power goes out, it still runs. I mean, that's just plain stupid.
Do you mean for storm shelters? Okay, I think we've got the essence of what David wanted to say here. Jane, how about the difference in the building codes in Joplin, and then talk to me a bit about storm shelters in your community.
Well, of course, you know, we're here in the Midwest, and with a mining heritage in Joplin, we probably have more rocks than soil here. So not very many houses in Joplin have a basement. You know, pre-tornado, 13% was the estimate of how many houses actually had a basement. And I would say overall, probably not very many houses had a storm shelter. So even though the city council made some modifications in building requirements, for example, we require hurricane straps, but we didn't mandate that a storm shelter be built in every new house that got built in Joplin. I think it probably has to do in some ways with an independent spirit and the fact that it's not up to the government to dictate, you know, what has to be in your house in the way of expenses. But I can tell you that as I drive around town, I see very few pieces of new construction where I can't see the storm shelters, the beginning piece of that.
Oh, really? Hmm. So it's not mandated, but a lot of people are choosing to do it.
Sure.
Mayor, I want to talk about how your building codes really changed to become much more green and sustainable. But how about this issue of, and we'll talk about that in a minute, how about this issue of the storm shelters?
Our basic issue was we, as Jane said, are very independent people. And we, as a city, took the approach we need to educate our citizens as much as possible, which we did, but they took it on their own, and there isn't a building or a new home in town that doesn't have a safe room or a storm shelter in the yard. Every municipal building and school, hospital, et cetera, has a FEMA-approved storm shelter, and that was by just voluntary to do that. When you start mandating that you've got to do something, that's perceived as the big brother government telling you what to do. So you do it with the educational process of allowing people to make their decisions within the budget they have available, and people realize they need to do it.
Let me grab a call here from Rick in Avon. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. You know, I've survived 6 tornadoes in the Minnesota area. Two or three in St. Cloud area and stuff. And I am so confused, this gentleman just spoke about Big Brother and requiring shelters. I'm in a plumbing business. There's codes to protect people. That's not Big Brother. That's a smart building. And when they rebuild in Mora, if those townspeople, those leaders, don't require fallout shelters, how many more lives do we have to lose? This is not Big Brother. I don't want to hear Big Brother. I want to hear love, kindness, and concern. You know, what does it take?
Mayor?
I cannot sleep at night.
Carrie, can I answer
that? Yeah, Mayor, please do.
Sir, I appreciate everything you're saying. And down at Moore, through the 99 tornado, through the 2003 tornado, and the one right now, there would have been way more lives lost if people hadn't back then put in storm shelters. And so please don't misunderstand when I say Big Brother. What I'm just talking about is people need to decide themselves, and they have. And we have improved building codes to be able to say that, like with mobile home parks and et cetera, there's certain things you have to do to be able to put them in with straps and everything else. So, yes, we are protecting the health and safety of our community, but this individual still has to make that decision on the total enhancement over the code that they want to take.
We're talking about rebuilding in a community in the wake of a devastating natural disaster. We're talking with citizens of 2 communities that have been through this. Greensburg, Kansas, where a tornado came through and devastated the town in 2007. And Joplin, Missouri. Nancy Cage with us from Joplin, Missouri, where, as you probably remember, in May of 2011, a tornado came through, an EF5. and devastated parts of that community. What does it take to rebuild? Some of the specifics of that, the mechanics of it. Greensburg really became a green community. We'll talk about how they did that. But also the psychological trauma. How do you rally the community around with the monumental task of building it again? 651-227-6000 to join us, 800-242-2828. And go to the page, Daily Circuit page, click on the Hour Show to comment, and reach me on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Look at the latest news and then back to the conversation. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Carrie. There's actually a band of thunderstorms in the Oklahoma City area this hour. It's slowing the cleanup operations there in the suburb of Moore, where a tornado killed 24 people this week. The National Weather Service says the storms are producing hail, heavy rain, and high winds. There's also a flash flood warning in effect for some areas. And there is the possibility later today and tonight for more tornadoes. In other news, British investigators are trying to determine whether the two suspects in yesterday's killing of a British soldier were part of a wider plot to bring terror to the streets of London. A British official says both men had been targets of previous security investigations for possible terror links. The men are suspected of hacking a soldier to death yesterday on the street as bystanders watched. A new rule on how European restaurants can serve olive oil is now off the books a week after being introduced. The European Commission said last week restaurants should only be allowed to serve oil to customers in non-refillable bottles with proper labeling. The EU said that ruling would prevent restaurants from serving low-quality oil and improve hygiene, but it also prompted ridicule by critics who say it shows the authorities in Brussels are out of touch with the real world. The refillable bottles are a staple in restaurants today. The commission said it's withdrawing the proposal. There's also a programming note here. The president will speak this afternoon about national security, including the U.S. drone policy. That's at 1 o'clock this afternoon. We will carry it live here on NPR News.
Later on All Things Considered, some 2%ers on Minnesota's new top-tier income tax.
It motivated me to sit down with our attorneys and our tax accountants to talk about not having a Minnesota residency just because of the cost.
Plus all the day's news starting at 3.
Support for this program comes from the College of St. Scholastica, offering an MBA program in Duluth, St. Cloud, and the Twin Cities. Fall classes start September 3rd. More at go.css.edu/MBA.
Read more about this hour's topic and leave a comment. Click on the Daily Circuit at nprnews.org.
I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up a little later in the hour, Climate Cast. We do this every week with meteorologist Paul Hudner. But today we're going to be talking about a lot of the speculation out there around the influence of climate change, the warming climate on tornadoes, like the monster tornado we saw come through Moore, Oklahoma on Monday. The science of that, the proven science of that. Paul Hudner with me for the Climate Cast a little later. This hour, we're talking about rebuilding in a community and what it takes both physically, emotionally, the mechanics of that. Jane Cage is with us. She's chair of the Citizens Advisory Recovery Team in Joplin, Missouri, and Mayor Bob Dixon is with us. He's the mayor of Greensburg, Kansas. Mayor, I want to come back to you and talk about the sustainability plan that you put into effect. Give me the essence of what you and the citizens of the town decided about becoming fully sustainable.
Well, Carrie, the one thing we had to remember in the midst of all this, we had ancestors that built a community to last lifetimes. Now, it was our responsibility to make sure in our planning process, in a sustainable master plan, to make sure that building codes were followed, that we encouraged people through the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, out of Golden, Colorado, through a nonprofit organizations to assist people in thinking through the process of building back as sustainable as they could within their budget, mm-hmm. to also implement as much energy-saving things that they could in their building process, because that helps maintain longevity of the structure, and also it maintains property value over decades. So we did not come through with, quote, new green building codes. We came through in an educational process to assist people to look at their house plan that they had chosen, to decide where windows were going to be, of what quality. There's there's a sense out there, and yes, it does cost a little more, but if you can put in top-notch, high-quality windows and doors, and you can cut your energy costs, you can spend more in the upfront costs to be green and sustainable.
And you got federal and state financial help to do that, didn't you?
Well, now, there's some misconception there. FEMA and the state only pay for tax-supported entities. They do not help, especially FEMA, any residential. That residential help comes through the SBA, the Small Business Administration. FEMA just pays 75% of what was there prior to the disaster. And then the state comes in and helps out. So we work very closely with state and federal agencies to be able to build structures that not only had storm shelters in it, FEMA approved, but also were good stewards of the environment in reusing materials, in utilizing wind, sun, and geothermal to heat and cool buildings.
Jane, I'm interested in whether there were building innovations or how you thought about the future when you were deciding what Joplin was going to look like as you rebuilt.
I think the key component for us was that rather being a plan that could have come from the top down, our plan was significant because it came from the bottom up. You know, we worked really hard, I believe, to listen to citizens in as many venues and realms as we could. And the plan is not what a group of community leaders decided, but really the compilation of what we heard. And so, unlike Greensburg, which has sustainability, I think, at its core, which was a brilliant move on their part, we went in the direction where we looked at really the different sectors of recovery. We looked at economic development. We looked at schools and community facilities. We looked at infrastructure and environment, kind of our piece of the green, and then housing and neighborhoods. So we worked in those four areas and developed a strategy for each one.
I want to bring Dr. Nancy Carlin into the conversation. She's been listening to a bit of this. She's a professor in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Northern Colorado. Dr. Carlin, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if you heard Mayor Dixon and Jane Cage saying, we went back to the community over and over again. It was essential that they felt like they had a key role in rebuilding. How important is that when a community goes through this?
It's extremely important to have that connection that takes place. That social connectedness is very much related to overall resiliency of the individual as they go through this type of crisis.
Make that connection for me. How so?
Social support mitigates many of the effects of crisis.
Really?
And with the research that we have been doing over the last several years across the world in various countries, what we're finding is those individuals that have that kind of connectedness to the community or to family members, friends, and et cetera, what you're going to find is that they tend to, in a sense, weather the storm much more effectively than those individuals that don't have that sense of connectedness. Now, the connectedness that they experience is oftentimes with regard to individuals showing concern for them as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
Whether individuals from the community or the government show concern about rebuilding isn't as tied to their overall ability to be resilient as it is that people just show concern for them as an individual.
And is that, Nancy, is that as in we all live through this and I can empathize with what you went through? Is it people that were only affected by it or people from outside that are showing that concern?
It's both. What you're typically going to find is when we're talking about government support of a devastation, like a tornado or an earthquake or a flood or something like that, government entities play a role in them getting back, individuals getting back on their feet. And in the United States of America, we have been blessed with the fact that in many times, our government, local, state, or federal, often provides support at any number of levels. However, outside the United States of America, they don't have that. And what we're finding is that their emotional resolve is oftentimes less pronounced than what we'll find in the United States. In fact, at Katrina, the elders in Katrina were had much higher level of mood state than individuals in other countries. And one of the primary reasons was that connectedness with people and also getting some of the support.
To the phones to Debbie in Orono. Hi, Debbie.
Well, hi. Good morning. I just had to chime in. I survived one of these in Belvidere, Illinois. It was famous in the 60s. I think it was 67. I was a sophomore in high school. And we had 21 children die because, and teachers, I believe, were some, two bus drivers I know, because it was right at the end of school on a Friday.
Yeah.
And in Illinois, everyone has basements. And I think this is part of the post-World War II generation. I lived in a small home about a mile away that was built after the war. And I think there was still that Eisenhower baby family, you know, building these small communities where you did what you did because it was post-war and we were used to preparedness. I do believe it's driven now by money, totally. When you see the open construction of houses, they do everything they can to avoid walls, extra windows for cost. But common sense tells you if you're in a tornado alley, the cost to lives and property and the cost to all of us as taxpayers is much bigger if you don't build these things. So when I got out of school, after I'd returned to get a gym suit, I would have been dead otherwise. It was right when the school was closing. So everything was flattened from our school, the West Side brand new high school, to the Chrysler plant. It was famous. It was in all the papers. And I can tell you, you don't want to live through one of those again. I do not understand why people in Moore are almost, and I don't mean to be unkind, but they're almost bragging about surviving four of these. What is in their mind? I have never gotten over it, Carrie. Never.
Debbie, I appreciate the call.
You bet.
To Murphy, listening on the road. Hi, Murphy. What's your experience with this? I'm well, thanks.
I'm actually from Oklahoma and recently moved to Minnesota. And I was actually involved with Habitat for Humanity immediately following the May 3rd, 99 tornado. They received a grant from America Online to build as many homes as they could with $1 million in that area that was devastated after 99. And we actually built storm shelters into every one of those homes.
Oh, in the Habitat homes?
Yeah, in the Habitat for Humanity homes. They were above ground storm shelters because, as many people have already commented on, there aren't basements or below ground storm shelters in most cases. In Oklahoma.
Right.
But, I mean, and we were using hurricane straps even prior to 1999 in the Habitat for Humanity homes. So, I mean, responsible builders will always go above and beyond what minimum code is if they have any pride in their work anyway.
Murphy, I appreciate the call and your experience. Dr. Carlin, I'm trying to think how to put this. It's interesting to hear our callers call in to say, I don't know if I could sleep at night if I knew, you know, that I was in a community where there weren't storm shelter. It's trying to insert some certainty into a situation that is, you know, a lot of it is just beyond your control. Do you know what I'm asking here?
Yeah. Well, disasters are diverse. And some experience stress-related growth where they have an increased appreciation for life and making new priorities, improvements in family relationships and things like that. And other individuals experience negative elements, including PTSD. What's interesting about individuals that have had multiple experiences with natural disasters, such as in the Louisiana area or Oklahoma or Kansas or even 5 years ago in Windsor, Colorado, where I live near, the issue is that a lot of individuals that successfully, in a sense, go through natural disasters actually experience something like an inoculation effect, almost like when you get a shot to prevent disease. When they are going through these experiences and they recognize the fact that they came out of it and maybe were able to rebuild possibly, but more importantly that they continue to survive, they continue to develop, what you find is that with each subsequent crisis in life, whether it's natural disaster or other, they, in many instances, are able to go back to that inoculation that they've already had and function much more effectively or effectively, in a sense, with those crises.
Mayor, does that resonate with you? Have you seen some of that in Greensburg?
Very much so. And Doctor, I totally agree with you that the resiliency and determination of the citizens of a disaster area, it makes you stronger. A disaster magnifies where you're at in life, emotionally and everything. And it does make you stronger. I would like to refer back to the last caller, if I may, real quick, Carrie.
Of course, Mayor. Go ahead.
About why would people build back after series of tornadoes over decades through the same area.
Right.
Well, we see the same thing happen with hurricanes and floods and earthquakes and everything else, all natural disasters. Why would people build back in a floodplain when it happens every 3 years? All my point is you do what you can as a municipality to minimize loss of life and minimize property damage, and encourage that through building codes and through public support with each other and public involvement. And I think that's what Jane's experienced in Joplin and Dr. Carlin's experienced in her studies, is it just makes people stronger and the human spirit really comes out.
You know, Jane, I was thinking about this because when I was watching the Moore, Oklahoma coverage, I saw an interview with one person who said, you know, I'm getting out of here. This is it. I've reached my limit. I can't face the idea that it could happen again. I'm surprised more people in a community like yours or Greensburg or all of the other places that have confronted these terrible natural disasters don't feel that way. But most people don't leave, do they?
No, they don't. And I think Bob made the good point and someone asked me this yesterday in an interview, you know, where is there a safe spot in the United States where we might be insulated from a natural disaster of some kind? I mean, I think the truth is that it happens everywhere. And so do I believe that we'll be better prepared when it happens to us the next time? No, I do believe we will. When I look at Moore, I think about the fact that they had that devastating tornado 14 years ago, you know, and then were hit again. And their loss of life is really very small because of the number of tornado shelters, I think, that were there already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they learned a lesson, and from that lesson, they prepared.
Nancy, I was thinking that different community members obviously cope with this differently. Some probably say, I've reached my limit. I cannot face the idea that even if it's 10 years down the road, I might experience this again. And others push that aside, I would guess.
Individuals typically are resilient after traumatic events. And that's a great thing about the human spirit. The difference is that for most individuals, there's a relationship between obstacle and opportunity. They see the obstacle, they see what's possible, but they also see it as an opportunity. And family relationships oftentimes, now this, there are exceptions to this, but family relationships oftentimes in times of trial really come together, and there's a lot of bonding that takes place. For the lady who indicated she was leaving Moore, Oklahoma, that she had it, she wasn't going to do this anymore,
mm-hmm.
She sees contradictions between obstacles and opportunities.
Hmm.
And she really doesn't see the connection there. And so we absolutely experience the same situation differently. And that happens with natural disasters or going to the grocery store. It's two totally different things to two different individuals.
Mayor, what do you understand about your community that you might not have known, you know, had Greensburg never experienced this?
Difficult question. A simple answer to that is the resiliency and the determination of the citizens of this community really came to the forefront of who we are. And we saw, I know Jane's experienced that in Joplin. They're experiencing it more all over the country where there's natural disasters. That human spirit steps up. If you people can decide whether to be humbly grateful that they have, even though it's a natural disaster, they can be humbly grateful that there's that opportunity to be there and share with each other in the rebuilding process, or you can be grumbly hateful that it happened to me. And so it's a choice in life, and we just need to continue to offer hope to anyone that has any kind of traumatic experience in life that there is a brighter tomorrow. We just need to make sure we're there to support each other, to pray for each other, and to get that input in post-disaster recovery.
Mayor, I thank you for the time today.
Thank you very
really
much.
Appreciate it. And Nancy, I want to point out something where the mayor said that, you know, most people do not say, why me? You don't see that even in a lot of the interviews, even in the minutes and the hours after this happened in Moore, Oklahoma. Do you have any insight as to why?
We see that consistently, especially in the United States of America, that they are resilient. They have this ability to bounce back following these challenges or loss. There tends to be this positive adjustment outcome that is perceived of these individuals. And a lot of it is a basic part of the United States, and that's that can-do attitude that you see here that you oftentimes don't see in underdeveloped countries, that we have this belief that we can, in fact, get to goal, that we can we have this self-efficacy, this belief that we can do what's necessary. And it absolutely takes place. When we were in Peru gathering data, the individuals that were middle-aged and elders there did not have that. But the elders and the middle-aged individuals that we have interviewed in this country are very different. The elders in Peru and in Italy simply would say, we hope for our children. We want them to become educated. In fact, there were signs all over villages that education was the way to eliminate disasters.
Huh.
In the United States, we don't have those signs up necessarily, but we have it in our hearts.
Right.
When we were in Italy, we would see individuals go back to these locations. They were so tied, and they were condemned, but elders would be sleeping on the porches of these homes because there was such a connectedness to that place. And humans have that. Where we exist becomes such a part of who we are, and we want to survive, and we want to go on.
Nancy Carlin, thank you very much for the time.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And Jane Cage, thank you and congratulations on the national award. I'm glad I'm really glad you could join the conversation. And Tom, news that President Obama is going to Moore, Oklahoma on Sunday.
He's also going to speak this afternoon about national security as well. We're going to bring that speech as well live at 1 o'clock. In other news this hour, Carrie, sales of new homes increased last month to the second highest level since the summer of 2008. Also, the median price for a new home hit a record high. Those are two more signs that housing is recovering. The Commerce Department said this morning new home sales rose to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of $454,000 in April. The median price in April was $271,600. That's the highest level on government records that date back to 1993. Schools should provide 60 minutes of physical activity every day for students and treat physical education as a core subject like reading and math. Those are the recommendations of the prestigious Institute of Medicine in a report that says only about half of the nation's youngsters are getting at least an hour of vigorous or moderate physical activity each day. The report also says 44% of school administrators report slashing big chunks of time from PE, arts, and recess ever since the passage of No Child Left Behind in 2001 in order so that they can boost classroom time for reading and math. The report advocates a whole-of-school approach where recess and before-and-after activities before and after school include sports that are encouraged to help reach that 60 minutes a day. Federal authorities are investigating after a Boeing 747 lost parts of its right wing and landed on a woman's house on approach to Atlanta. The China Airlines flight landed safely on Sunday. There were no injuries. Homeowner Pamela Ware told an Atlanta TV station she's thankful she survived after part of the wing hit her house. Station reports another piece of the plane also landed in front of a Walmart a few miles away. More coming up here on the Daily Circuit.
Programming is supported by the College of St. Benedict, educating women for 100 years, celebrating a century of connection. More at csbcentennial.com. College of St. Benedict, where one little light can illuminate hundreds of lives.
Support for this program on Minnesota Public Radio comes from Flint Hills Resources Refinery in Rosemount, presenting the 13th annual Flint Hills International Children's Festival at Rice Park in St. Paul, June 1st and 2nd. More information at ordway.org.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
In Kansas, it was 118 degrees. Now, you leave a candle on your porch in that kind of temperature, and it melts like a stick of butter.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
It's time for ClimateCast, my weekly discussion with Paul Hudner about the science of climate change. Hi, Paul. Good to have you back in the studio.
Great to be here, Carrie, and good to see that bright object up in the sky today.
What is that again?
I didn't know what to do.
Hey, as you know, social media has been full of speculation about whether climate change had anything to do with the size and the intensity of the tornado that came through Moore, Oklahoma. So I thought we would spend a little time talking about what we know and what we don't know. What do we know about the connection between tornadoes, the intensity of tornadoes, and the change in climate?
Well, the answer is we don't know a lot, and the trends don't seem to show much. There's really no real clear connection between an increase in the most violent tornadoes, these EF4, EF5 monsters that we saw in Moore, and climate change. If you look at the trends from 1950 on, or even back before that, you don't see a real uptick in these most violent tornadoes, Carrie. So it's one of those things that we really can't connect all the dots on. It doesn't seem to be any conclusive evidence that it's changing.
We do know, though, that tornadoes thrive in humid, unstable air. Now, I remember that in previous conversations, we've talked about more of those kinds of conditions because the climate is warming and changing.
That's right.
Might there be a connection there?
There are two things going on that you really need to create tornadoes. One is you need that warm, humid, moist air mass to generate thunderstorms. And with the climate change we're seeing, warmer temperatures and more water vapor in the atmosphere, that is happening. That part of it appears to be happening. So as you model this out, as NOAA looks at this and other people, it looks like we are seeing an increase in thunderstorms. The second thing you need is wind shear. You need these rotating, spinning winds with height to create these rotating supercell thunderstorms, these tornadic supercells that produce tornadoes. And the other part of climate change is as we reduce the contrast between the poles and the equator, we're getting less wind shear. So that part of it, they appear to be counteracting each other. And overall, it seems to look like a wash in terms of more tornadoes or more violent tornadoes.
I just want to be clear on what you've just said. You've said that there seem to be an increase in frequency of these intense thunderstorms, but wind shear is also a necessary ingredient to create a tornado, and that seems to be diminishing.
Exactly. You need these rotating thunderstorms, these spinning storms, to produce these tornadoes to get that circulation focus down to the lowest level. And it looks like there's less wind shear overall. So the two may be counterbalancing each other out, and we're just not seeing that remarkable increase that some might expect.
That wind shear research comes out of the University of Oklahoma Norman, doesn't it? A researcher who's doing that there.
Right, a lot of it does, and the National Severe Storms Lab is based in Norman, Oklahoma, which is just, if people know the geography of Oklahoma City, it's Oklahoma City, then Moore is a southern suburb, and then Norman, which used to be a college town in the rural areas, is now essentially a suburb of Oklahoma City. There's been so much growth in between, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing more of these urban tornadoes. The cities are expanding into areas that were farmland 20, 30, 40 years ago. And Carrie, you know, it's worth noting that if there is an epicenter in Tornado Alley, Moore, Oklahoma has to be it. It's had three EF4, EF5 tornadoes in the past 14 years. This one looks like over $2 billion in damage, could be the third costliest in U.S. history, and there have only been $9 billion tornadoes in the United States.
Paul, we should say why that epicenter seems to zero in right on Moore, Oklahoma. It has to do somewhat with distance from the Gulf, right?
Yes.
And the weather systems that come up out of there. And what else?
Has to do with distance from the Gulf, which is your moisture source, cold air, which usually comes in either from where we are in the Northern Plains or the Rockies. Oklahoma sits just in the perfect spot. And we're also finding out it has to do perhaps with local topography. So as these storms spin up, the cold air meets that moisture and the warm air right in places like Oklahoma. That's why we call it Tornado Alley. But it also turns out, and they're finding out, folks like Howie Bluestein and Josh Werman, who run these mobile Dopplers on wheels, the Dow, the Doppler on wheels, they measured that 300-plus mile-an-hour wind directly in the last tornado in Moore, Oklahoma, the 1999 one. That topography and these small microscale vortices play a role. So if you have these nice flat open spaces, it doesn't interfere with these tiny wind eddies that can come together to form these monster tornadoes.
You're listening to the Climate Cast. This is the weekly conversation that we have on Thursday mornings with NPR meteorologist Paul Hudner about the science of the changing climate. To bring this back to climate change and tornadoes, Paul, you and I have talked in the past about how the Gulf Stream is being affected by the changing climate.
Mm-hmm.
Might what's happening with the Gulf Stream at some point be contributing to an increase in tornadoes?
You know, I don't know that we know the answer to that, Carrie. The Gulf Stream, of course, sits off the Atlantic coast. It's a long way from what we call Tornado Alley. It's hard to find a direct connection between that and what's happening, I think, in Oklahoma and Texas. And to be honest, we really still do not know exactly the mechanisms that trigger tornado formation. That's why there's still a lot of research going on. One of the interesting things about this tornado, I think, from a success standpoint, it was a meteorological success. There was 16 minutes warning before the funnel first touched down, 30 minutes before it got to Moore, and folks telling people to get out of the way once they saw how big this tornado was. People were literally getting in their cars and told to get in their cars and drive away from their homes because without basements in Oklahoma, as you know,
right,
you were not going to survive this tornado above ground. So this warning, I am convinced, saved far more lives than the 24 that we lost in Moore, Oklahoma.
I just want to note also, Paul, because we talk a lot on this segment about knowing the science and what we know about the science of climate change and what we don't know. This is kind of a good lesson in not jumping to conclusions, because immediately after the tornado came through, a lot of speculation. Well, look at that. It's got to be climate change.
That's right. And the data just doesn't support it. If you look back at the numbers, there's really, and you take out the weaker tornadoes, there's really no increase in most tornadoes, in these violent tornadoes, since 1950.
I want to also note that we got some other climate news here about less snow building up on the top of mountaintops in North America, and the Rockies going through Colorado and the Northern Plains states are good examples of what's happening.
And this is important because it tells us that the climate is warming at higher altitudes. It's not just at the ground where we live. It's not an urban heat island effect. This is happening at 15, 20,000 feet. The Rockies, Carrie, have lost 20% of their snow cover in the last 30 years. Since 1980, this enhanced springtime warming, these warmer springs, are melting the snowpack at a faster rate throughout the Rockies early in spring. And that's regardless of how much winter snowfall has occurred.
That's what I wanted to add, because Denver, Colorado, got a very tough winter like we did.
Right.
Cold and lots of snow late into the season.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how much snow falls?
Apparently not, because once you get, you know, it's fairly sunny in the west, you get into spring, once you get the warm-up and you have the sunshine, the snowmelt process happens very rapidly. So this is pretty remarkable and important stuff. You know, runoff from the Rockies fuels 60 to 80% of the water supply for about 70 million people. And it's not just the Rockies, it's Mount Everest, which is showing signs of the snow and ice moving up higher 540 feet on Mount Everest. Mount Everest, the water tower for Asia, it supplies snow and ice and that runoff for water downstream. And you and I have talked before about the Andes, these high glaciers in the Andes that are showing the same trends.
Is this because it is just simply staying warmer at these altitudes for longer periods of time because of the changing climate?
Yes, that's part of it. And another part of it appears to be that more of the high elevation precipitation is falling as rain rather than snow. So instead of accumulating the snow and the ice, it's falling as rain at a higher elevation. That actually can melt snow and wash it away. So just another sign the atmosphere is warming at depth in the as you go up in the atmosphere.
And by the way, you and I talked about glaciers, and when I was traveling in Patagonia in December, I saw some of those glaciers.
Awesome.
That's part of the issue there, too. It's precipitation coming down in rain and not compacting snow on top of the glacier.
That's it. And it's changing a lot. You know, we're seeing these changes around the planet. It's not just in one spot. You know, Carrie, we talk about this stuff. It sounds a little overwhelming at times. Mm-hmm. I'm going to post today on our ClimateCast blog some things you can do from the EPA. We don't advocate a course of action, but there's a lot of information out there, and there are things that people can do in their own lives if they're concerned
about this. Is that going up on the Updraft blog?
It'll be on Updraft later today.
I bookmark Updraft. I look at it every day,
I love
Paul.
You.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks,
good to
Carrie.
Have you here. Meteorologist Paul Huttner with us. Check out the Updraft blog. But that's the ClimateCast for the week, our conversation about the science behind climate change. This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.